Okay, we begin here by the Mishnah on Kuf Dalet Amud Aleph. The Mishnah says, Chaltza b'layla, chalitzata k'shera. They did a chalitza at night. It's okay. K'shera usually means bidiabad. We don't recommend doing it that way, but if you did do it, it's fine. Rabbi Elazar posel. Rabbi Elazar says it's no good. Bismol, on the left, chalitzata psula. It's problematic. V'Rabbi Elazar makshir. Rabbi Elazar says it's fine. So leima bahaka miflagei. Let's say that this is the argument here about why at night is it considered to be kshera or psula. The marsover makshinan rivim lenigayim. That we draw a connection or parallel between riv, which is an altercation that's brought to Beit Din, versus a nega, which involves a certain amount of involvement of the kohen, of the parties that are in power. And the other one thinks that that's not the case. Because by nega, you have to see the nega during the yom, because it says, v'yom hera'ot bo, that you have to actually see it by daylight. You can't use artificial light to see the nega. It has to be seen by the daylight. And therefore, the nega'im can only be seen during the day. So we know for certain that nega'im is only done during the day. The question is, in the pasuk that brings them together, v'chol riv, v'chol naga, the riv and nega are brought adjacent to each other in the pasuk, does that mean then the dinim of nega, which means during the day, also apply to riv, which involves other types of matters of the courts? Are they also subject to this issue of only being done during the day? It says lo. The kuliyama lo makshina and rivim lenigayim. Now nobody thinks that there is such a hekesh. Now this doesn't mean generically nobody thinks that. It just means in this case. Our Mishnah, these authorities, these Tanaim don't think that. There are other opinions who do think that, but it's not relevant to our Mishnah here. Di makshinan afilu gmar din belaila namilo. Because if you think there is a hekesh, then even your gmar din you would not be able to do at night, which is not the case, because we know that the rules are that one may not start a din at nighttime. But one can complete, have a gemar din at night, at least with the gabei dinei mimonot, then you can finish it up at night. If you did have such a hekesh and put riv with nega, nega says only daytime, no, there's no room, no give at all. That means that you would have to do dinei mimonot during the day, even the gemar din. And we don't have, that's not the way that we say. This is their argument now. That chalitza is equivalent to a beginning of a case, a beginning of adjudication. Marzav chalitza ki gemar din damyo. It's the psak halacha. It is the reading of the judgment. So therefore, the difference will come up, which we just mentioned, which is that tchila din must be during the day. Sof din can be even at night. The gemar din can even be at night. And that's the machloket in the Mishnah is, which aspect does it have, chalitza? Does chalitza have the aspect of a tchilat din? Or does chalitza have an aspect of gemar din? Now David asked the question is, well, isn't riv and the din that we're speaking about here are adjudications of monetary matters? It's civil court in that sense. What does this have to do with chalitza? So Rashi already says over here, v'chalitza din hu degova ktubata. Rashi says, oh, chalitza is also a matter of din because now she's going to be given permission to collect her ktubah from the estate. As long as she's a Shomer Tiyavam, she's not allowed to collect her ktubah. She's not entitled to her ktubah. As soon as he releases her, then she gets her ktubah. So the chalitza, as a derivative of that, also has a monetary impact, which is that of the ktubah. It's interesting. Tosafot in Sota. The Gemara in Sota discusses whether the issues of Sota are Dine Mimonot or Dine Isur. And over there, Tosafot goes back and forth, but deals with this issue of the ktubah, which is that, with regards to Sota, if she refuses to drink, if there's a problem here, she will lose her ktubah. On the other hand, if she goes through with the process, she will get her ktubah. So, is the issue of Sota an issue of Isur, or is it an issue of Mamon? Now, that has nafka minot, for instance, when we pass on like Rav and Shmuel. Halacha is kerabi surei kishmuel b'mamonot. So, how is it negdar, Sota? Is it a din in dinei mamonot, or is it a din in Isur? So that Tosafot, it's interesting over here because Rashi is doing something similar, which is chalitza is clearly an issue of Isur, whether she is mutar or not mutar to the olam, because once she gets chalitza, she's released. When she didn't have chalitza, she's a sur the olam. She has to wait around until she's released by one of the brothers. So it's clearly an issue of Isur. Yeah, we're saying here that it has implications. It has monetary implications. And therefore, it has like shame, like a din. That's the way Rashi learns the sugya over here. And that's why it's considered to be a din. There are many of the other Rishonim who disagree with Rashi because, again, ketubah is a derivative of the isur. It's not the main part of the case here. And rather, why is it considered to be a din? It's because of what we saw before, the requirement that it be done before a beit din. It's not a din in the classic sense of adjudication, but it's din in the sense of you have to do it in front of beit din. You have to do it in front of individuals who are a beit din. Right, but they take on a shame. Right, but they take on a shame beit din here. The Mishnah called them a beit din. Right, even though they were hedyotot, the Mishnah calls them a beit din. So it has to be done in front of a beit din, and therefore it's called a din for that reason. By din imanot, it's done with hedyotot, it's also called a din and a beit din. So for that reason, it's considered to be a din. Now others explain that the machloka here is exactly that, which is what is the status of a ketubah after chalitza. Is chalitza the opening salvo, which means that now she has chalitza, she moves on to the next stage, which is now she can make a claim for her ketubah, and then you would consider it like tchilat din, because then I mean you've just gone into the process of collecting the ketubah. Or is it that once the chalitza is done, she's automatically empowered to collect her ketubah, and then it'd be like a gemar din? So that could be the explanation of their machloket here. How do you view ketubah vis-a-vis the chalitza? Is the chalitza automatically grant her the right to ketubah? Or is chalitza open her possibilities now of collecting on her ketubah? And that would be the difference between tchilat din and gemar din. Rabba bar Chiya ketosva, avad uvda b'muk, ubi chidi, ubalayla. So he went ahead and he performed a chalitza. He was part of a beit din or oversaw a chalitza. And in this chalitza, there were a number of things that happened. Number one, it was done with a muk, which is, yesterday we mentioned, in the breita type of shoe that either is it's a thinner shoe that comes up the leg, or many people said it was a shoe made out of felt, this muk. Ubi yichidi, he did it alone. Ubalayla, and at night. So obviously we know from our mission over here about Laila. Amar Shmuel, Kamarav Guvrei, how powerful this individual is. David ki yechida. Because he now took three items that are all halachot that are paskin by individuals against the rabbim. And he took that, basically a dat yechid, in all three of these issues of Laila, yechidi, and muk. So when it says, my kasha, which one is bothering him here? What's the issue here? Imuk. If you're talking about a muk, stamatanyo, that was brought in a breita. We saw this breita. That's what started out yesterday's daf when we spoke about the breita that they brought to support Rava's contention that there's a difference between anfiliot shel beged and anfiliot shel or. In that breita, it says that a muk is fine, that a muk is one of the things that is considered to be a shoe. That's a stam breita. That has no attribution. So what is he talking about a dat yachid there? Muk is certainly not a dat yachid. It's a breita that's a stam breita. Ilayla. We ask about Laila, Stamotanyo. Our Mishnah, right, we have here that says it, doesn't give attribution to who it is. It says, Chalatza Balaila Chalitztak Sheira. Rabbi Elazar Posel is seemingly the Dat Yachid over here, but in terms of the Tanakama, we don't have any attribution. Ela Yachidi. That he did it alone, Kakashale. That's what bothered him. Heichi Ovid Bi Yachidi. How did he do this alone? The Yachido Tani Lo. Because that is an opinion of a dat yachid, which is the tnan. Chalitza b'shnayim o b'shlosha. Did chalitza with two or three. V'nimtza echad mehem karov v'pasul. And we found one of them to be either a relative or someone who was pasul le'edut. He had two or three. And then they found one of them to be a pasul or karov. That means that the remaining number is two. Chalitzata psula. That disqualifies the chalitza. Rabbi Shimon v'Rabbi Yochanan Sandar machshirin. They say it's fine. Umase bechad shchalatz beno lebena. There was a case where a person performed chalitza privately with this woman, but beit asurim. He was incarcerated, so he had to perform chalitza. They didn't have edim there, so he got snuck in or whatever and got there to do the chalitza. But there were no edim to the matter. They did it by themselves. Ba mase lefnei Rabbi Akiva, came before Rabbi Akiva v'ichshir, and he said it was fine. This is interesting because Rabbi Akiva himself spends time in the beit asurim. And has issues of people visit him in the Beit HaSurim. And I don't know when in Rabbi Kiva's lifetime this was that the incident took place. But then we have a memra from the Amoraim that the Locha is not like that pair being Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yochanan Sandar, who clearly say that with a single individual, that it is fine. Because the case before was he had three or two, and then they found one of them to be a pasul or karov. That means that the remaining number is two and one. So that means that you could have one left over, according to them, and be fine in terms of performing chalitza. From their psak, or from their position, you see that a yachid would be able to do it. But that is the position of Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yochanan, Sanlar. And that's a, call it dat yachid, not in the classic sense of one individual, but dat yachid means it's a minority opinion. And on top of that, we see that we don't paskin like that opinion. So that's why Shmuel was pointing out that it was somewhat of a difficult procedure that he did here, because he took on a dat yachid to do it with one person, with one individual, meaning that he was the only one supervising the whole process of chalitza. Now, the way I explained it is based on the Tosafot on Kuf Hei Amud Bet, who says that Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yochanan Sandar in the Mishnah also think that a yachid is sufficient in terms of the process of chalitza. Rashi on the Mishnah on the Amud Bet does not say that, and he says that actually there are three different opinions in the Mishnah. There's the Tana Kama who believes that you need three. There's Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yochanan Sandar that believe you need two. And then there's Rabbi Akiva who believes that you need one or none at all. And then the question is that he was following the position of Rabbi Akiva, which literally would be then a dat yachid. How Rashi explains the Lashon HaMishnah, according to Tosafot, Rashi didn't have to have the gears of Shnayim in the Mishnah, and therefore the case was Shlosha, and then they lost one of them because they were a Karova Pasul. Others explain the Lashon HaMishnah like this. Either there were Shnayim, or Shlosha, and one of those Shlosha was made Pasul or a Karov. So then you ended up with Shnayim again. In that case, that's where Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yochanan Sanlar say that that is okay. So that's the way that Rashi learns the Mishnah versus the way that we explained it, which is Tosafot on Kuf Hei Amud Bet and some of the other Rishonim. Now it's interesting the parties that are involved here, because the Psak Halacha comes from Rav Nachman, who's a Talmid of Shmuel. And Shmuel here is speaking to Rabbi Barachia Ketosafah, who is older than him. And the Gemara brings out, the Halacha is not like that Oto Zug about someone from the Talmidim of Shmuel. So just interesting interplay here. I mean that the Gemara is obviously picking up things that are not relevant to the exact story, because Shmuel speaking, unless they think that Rav Nachman Paskin this way because they heard it from Shmuel, but the fact that Rav Nachman Paskin that way came after the fact of the story, it's not at the time of the story because he's a Talmud of Shmuel. Some others say that even all this are dat yachid, I mean all three issues are dat yachid, muk, laila, and this case of yachid, the Tanya. Amar Rabbi Shmuel b'Rabbi Yossi, ani ra'iti et Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha, shechalatz v'muk b'yachidi b'laila. So he brings evidence of the fact that there was this dat yachid who did this, which I saw Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha, that was chalatz v'muk b'yachidi b'laila. So he said that's the precedent, but if that's the precedent you're talking again about, then for sure you're talking about a dat yachid. If that's what he's using as the paradigm, then you're talking about a single individual giving a psak halacha. Now what's interesting over here, Tosafot already raises the issue, which is Rabbi Shmuel b'Rabbi Yossi, we saw actually, together, Rabbi Shmuel b'Rabbi Yossi sat before Rabbi. He was kafuf to Rabbi. And there the story is that Rabbi, even though Rabbi Yossi, his father, was also kafuf to Rabbi, nevertheless, because of his stature, Rabbi gave him a little more leeway. But it means that Rabbi Shmuel b'Rabbi Yossi was a Talmid in front of Rabbi. Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha is a contemporary of Rabbi Akiva. So that means that you're talking about two, three generations apart in terms of their ability here. So how is it possible that Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi saw Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha, who was three generations older than him? Very unlikely that he would have seen him. So that's why Tosafot over here says that unlikely that this was the case. So Umad Perish read the Trey Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha, Abu Atu Shapir. If you say there are two Rabbi Shmuel ben Elishas, then it makes a lot of sense. Because, as we know from Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, or Rabbi Gamliel, that every other generation, you had a Shimon and then a Gamliel. That the Beit Nasi, there's Rabbi Gamliel as a Cain, then there's Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, then there's Rabbi Gamliel, but there's Rabbi Gamliel ben Shimon, and there's another Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel the second. I mean, that the family had the same name, so you have multiple people like that. So if that's the case, if you say there's more than one Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha, and therefore there will be another Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha, who is the grandson of the one who was the contemporary of Rabbi Akiva, and he would be contemporary with Rabbi Shmuel ben Rabbi Yossi. Then if you do that, you can work it out that we're talking about people who were contemporaries rather than three generations apart. And now the Gemara says, "B'smol chalitzata psula." So my time with the Rabbanon. Why do the Rabbanon say that it's psula? Amarula yalfinan regel, regel mitzora. We learn out regel, regel from mitzora, zereshavo. Over here it says, chalitza na'alo mi'araglo, to take the shoe off his foot. And over there by Mitzora, it says that you have to put it on a Bohen Ragloha Yimanit. You have to put it on his big toe. So you see the word regal over there means right. So regal over here also means right. Malalan Diyamin, Afkan Diyamin, just like over there it means right, so too over here means the right side. Now, in terms of what we're talking about here, there are two people involved in the process. There's the woman, the Yavama, and there's the Yavam. The Gemara here is discussing the Yavam and which leg the shoe is on. Is the shoe on his right leg or is it on his left leg? The Chachamim is saying it has to be on his right leg. So as far as the woman is concerned, it doesn't matter if she's using her left hand, her right hand, because we're going to see later on in the Gemara, even if she uses her teeth to undo the shoelace, that's enough. As long as she's the one that's releasing the shoe, doesn't matter how she releases the shoe. So the right and left here are not relevant about her interaction with the Yavam, but rather the Yavam himself. Right, so exactly. So what Fred is raising is a serious issue, which is, how do you know that there's even the Gemara cares about right and left when it comes to legs? Why is right and left relevant when it comes to a leg? So the truth is that the Gemara in a number of places does mention this. Some cite Bechorot. I think of the Gemara by Mezuzah. The Gemara by Mezuzah talks about how do you know that the Mezuzah goes on the right side? So there it says because it says when you come into your house. Right? When you come into your house, how do you enter your house first? The Gemara there says that your right leg goes first. And that the Gemara is talking about people who favor their right side and they walk with their right leg first. Which means the Gemara knows that there are people who favor their right side and there are people who favor the left side. Most people who are righties are also going to favor their right leg. And therefore there's a right-legged person in that sense, and that's why mezuzah goes on the right side. But that does imply that there's also people who have a left side, have preference for the left side. So now then you'd have to ask, here in this case we call iter yad, which is a question all over Shas, lefties, what do you do in terms of lefties? Right? Does that matter? If you're going to say there's a difference in the legs between right and left, in the sense of one is stronger or one is the one that you go first with, then what does a lefty do if their left leg is the one that is takes precedence, even for righties? Some of them have the left leg that is stronger. And there, in that case, do you have to do it on the left leg instead of the right leg? So the possibility is that it makes no difference here, because yamin, and this is true, I've spoken about this in the past, but in terms of lefty and righty, when it comes to halachot that are generic halachot, then in that case, we always favor the right side, and it doesn't matter lefty or righty. So for instance, going around the Mizbeach, where you turn to the right side, everybody turns to the right side, even lefties would turn to the right side by the Mizbeach, or they go around on the right side, because that is something that we look at from the general side. But looking at that, in general, people are going to be righties, people are going to favor the right side, therefore we give precedence to the right. But when you're talking about something that is unique or specific to the individual, so for instance, tefillin, where the Torah has a specific limit of yadcha, yad keha, or when you're talking about tying, like a shoelace, something like that, where it's specific to the dexterity of the individual, over there we make a difference between right and left. So it actually comes up, I mentioned this, with regards to shoes, brought down in Shulchan Aruch, that once you put on their right shoe first, then their left shoe, then tie their left shoe, and then tie their right shoe. Why do you put your right shoe on first? Because you always put the right on first. Why do you tie your left shoe first? Because that's the side that you tie your tefillin on. That's the side you put your tefillin on. What about a lefty? A lefty puts his tefillin on the right side. So there, the halacha gets bifurcated. In terms of putting on the shoe, you put on the shoe on the right foot first, even for a lefty. Because again, that has nothing to do with left or right. That has to do with the world at large. People favor their right side, so we put the right foot on first. That's true for the lefty as well. So he'll put his right shoe on first as well. Then put on his left shoe. When it comes to tying the shoe, the lefty will tie his right shoe first, then his left shoe, because for him, tefillin are on the right side. So over here also, you could argue that the right and left don't matter here, because we're not looking for something that involves the dexterity of the individual, the action of the individual. Simply, if we have to choose between right and left, which side are you choosing? You choose right. So that'll apply to all. There are others who say no, that this is subject to the same rules everywhere else. For iter yad, someone's a lefty, well, then have to put on their left leg instead of their right leg. Or it seems to me that we should favor putting on a right even for lefties based on the principle that I just established for you, that we're not looking for a specific about the individual, we're looking at the generic situation. Right now, Rabbi Elazar lo yoliv regel mi mitzora. So now, based on what you're implying here, is that the reason the Chachamim say it's psula is because they learn regel mi mitzora, which implies that Rabbi Elazar thinks that there is no limit of regel mi mitzora. Vatanya. How do you know when it comes to piercing the ear of an Eved Ivri who's going to stay until the Yovel, that is done on the right ear? Nemar kan ozen, v'nemar lahalan ozen. It says ozen by the piercing of the ear of the Rebbe Divri, by the nirtza. It also says it by mitzora, ozen. Malahalan yamin, afkan yamin, just like by mitzora, it's on the right ear. So it's over here, it's going to be on the right ear. Amar Rav Yitzchak by Yosef, Amar Rav Yochanan, mukhlevet hashita. In Ochanami, you got to flip their opinions. The opinions are reversed over here in order that Rabbi Lazar be consistent in his opinion that he has the limud from Mitzora. In both cases, we're going to have to flip the opinion here so that Rabbi Lazar is consistent. He's the one who thinks that you need regal, regal, ozen, ozen. And by flipping the opinion, then you have a consistency within Rabbi Lazar's position. Rav Amar lolom lo tipoch. Don't flip their positions. Ozen, ozen, mufne. Regal, regal, lo mufne. Over here you have gzeres shava. And a gzeres shava, you can be dan if, again, there is an opening, there's an extraneous word that is there. The extraneous word allows you then to override any logical argument against it. If you don't have an extraneous word, then logic will dictate here. Even if you have a gzeres shava, we're going to say, well, if the logic dictates against it, we're not going to listen. And we know that Rabbi Lazar believes that mufne mitzad echad lemeidim umeishivin. That when it comes to mufne on one side, if one of them is extraneous, that is not sufficient in order to have gzeres shava that overrides logic. You need it to be extraneous on both sides to override logic. And Rashi says, this Gemara here is the paradigm. When we quote in the Shas, anywhere you quote in Shas, which we know about Rabbi Lazar that says, Mufna mitzad echad lemeidim umeishivin, that's from our Gemara over here. Because by Mitzora, it's clearly extraneous. Because Mitzora, anybody who is laying Parsha Mitzora, remembers the beginning of Mitzora, you have a Parsha of the Tarat Mitzora, which is repeated twice. Once for the Ashir, and once for the Ani, because the Korban of the Ashir and the Ani are different. But then it doesn't just tell you that their Korban is different, it goes through the entire Parsha twice. So there the Gemara says that second Parsha of Ani, those are all extraneous words. The word Regel, Ozen, Yad in that second Parsha are clearly extraneous because the Torah didn't need to repeat them. Could have just put, tell you, this is the Korban for an Ashir, this is the Korban for the Ani, and that's it, and you would have. Why did it repeat the whole Parsha? That's extraneous. So that side is for sure Mufne. The question is, by the other side, is it mufne? Is the raglo over here by chalitza mufne? And is the ozen that is mentioned by nirtza, is that also mufne? And that's what he's saying over here. Ozen, ozen, mufne. Over there, it's available. Both sides are extraneous. Since both sides are extraneous, therefore, you can have the gzer shava. Rego, rego, lo mufne. By rego, we need ma'al raglo here. We learned plenty of things from ma'al raglo here by chalitza, which would indicate that it's not extraneous. We learned about Mi'al Raglo, taught us yesterday about the location that you can even do it on the shulk. Learned that you can't have a shoe on top of a shoe. So that we have many limudim from the word. The word doesn't seem extraneous at all. It says, V'chilo mifne my pircha ika. Okay, now you only need it to be extraneous if there's a logical argument that would mitigate the gezeres shava. So it means here that you think there's a problem with this gezeres shava. There's a reason not to learn the gezeres shava. It says, Ika mifrach ma'al metzorah shekein ton eitz erez ve'ezovu shni tolat. The reason is that Mitzora is an unusual process of Tara, which is that not only involves Korbanot and going to the mikveh, it involves a whole procedure beforehand with the cedar wood and the rush and the Shni Tolat and the crimson string. So that whole process with the birds and being Mitaher, the Mitzora already means that maybe Mitzora is too unique, that you can't use that as a paradigm for other things because Mitzora is an unusual case. And therefore, we're not going to extrapolate from Mitzora to other areas. So that's the pircha. Unless it was mufne, unless it was extraneous on both sides, and the gzeres shava then would ignore logic or any argument against it. But we don't have that by the case of regel. We do have that by the case of ozen. And that's why Rabbi Lozer has a differentiated opinion. In one case, he does learn it. In the other case, he doesn't learn it. By regel, regel, he does not learn it. By ozen, ozen, he does learn the gzeres shava. Okay, now next Mishnah. Chaltza virakaka. She did the chalitza, she took off the shoe, v'rakaka, and she spit. Aval lo kar'a. But she did not read the parsha that she's supposed to say, v'amra. She did the part that she has to say, she doesn't do that. Chalitza tak shira. Over there, it's fine. Bidyavad, the chalitza is fine. Kar'a, v'rakaka. She read the parsha, she spit. Aval lo chalitza. She did not do the chalitza, removing the shoe. Chalitza ta psula. There, the chalitza is psula. So over here, it's clear that the taking off of the shoe is me'akev. Right? That's why it's called chalitza. I mean, that's the name itself comes from the removal of the shoe. In terms of the kara, reading the parsha, that's clearly not me'akev. Now the question comes up with chaltza v'kara. If she does the removal of the shoe, And she read the parsha, avalo rakaka, she did not spit. What's the story there? So Rabbi Elazar, there are many who changed the girsa to Rabbi Eliezer over here, because in general, we have in the Mishnah, when you find Rabbi Kiva arguing, it's usually with Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Elazar ben Hurkunus, who happens to be his Rabbi. So it's more likely that Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Eliezer are the two Tanaim here, rather than Rabbi Elazar. Again, our Mishnah has Rabbi Elazar printed in it, but you can see that there are many that changed it to Rabbi Eliezer. So Rabbi Elazar Omer Chalitzata Psula, that the Chalitza is problematic. Rabbi Kiva Omer Chalitzata Kshera. So here you have a machloket. Is spitting integral to the process or not? Amar Le Rabbi Eliezer Kacha Yaseh. It says that this is the way that we do. Now Kacha Yaseh means Le Ikuva. And that whenever you have the word Kacha or Otacha, these certain words that the Gemara notes as being things that make it the Ikuv. So Kacha will here also be the Ikuv, even though it's interesting over here because the Kacha Yaseh is not a said about the process. It's something that the woman says, part of her speech, or part of what she needs to say. So it's interesting that the Gemara here still uses that to teach you that there's an Ikuv here, even though it's a part of her speech. Kol davar shu ma'aseh me'akev. So it says anything that's an action is me'akev. It says kacha, yaseh. Anything that's a maseh is me'akev. Tosafot, the top of tomorrow's daf, does ask, according to the one who says that kriya, reading or speaking, is considered to be a maseh, then why isn't that me'akev according to Rabbi Eliezer? Because it says kacha yaseh. That is a maseh that is done and should be me'akev as well. So Tosafot gives the answer that even though it's a maseh, kriya, it's a maseh zutar, it's maseh garua. It's not a full-fledged action or activity, and therefore it's not governed by kacha yaseh versus rikika, which is a full-fledged action. On the other hand, the Tosafot HaRosh gives a different answer, which is that kriya, or speaking, is only considered to be a maseh when it leads to something befoal, when it leads to something that actually comes out. There the Gemara is talking about driving an animal. So if you tell the animal, or say something to the animal, and it drives the animal forward, that's a kriya or speaking that has a maseh that is a derivative of that speaking. And therefore it's going to be a maseh. But speaking in and of itself is not necessarily considered to be a maseh. And therefore it would not be governed by kacha yaseh. That explanation is somewhat difficult because we find by edut also that there's a suggestion that the kiamat sfatayim, that the movement of the lips is considered to be a maseh for speaking. Over there by edut, you could argue that there is a active derivative from that. The person's going to get death penalty or some sort of punishment by Beit Din. Or in a civil case, maybe there will be a monetary change of hands. But there it's a little less straightforward as to what the Tosafot HaRosh says. And maybe that's why Tosafot opted to say that's still considered to be a maaseh zutar or a maaseh garua versus the maaseh of rikika, which is a full-fledged maaseh. Ramalei Rabbi Kiva, Misham Raya. That's, you kind of excerpted, you parsed it in a way that doesn't create a question. But I'll tell you, if you read the whole pasuk, it says, kacha yaseh la'ish. This is the way that you do it to the man. Kol davar shu maseh be'ish. Anything that is a maseh for the ish, then that is something that's ma'akev. So only thing is something the woman does to the man. What is something the woman does to the man? That's the chalitza. It's the taking the shoe off of him. The spitting is not done to him. It's done in front of him, but it's not done to him. So that's what Rabbi Kiva says, it's not ma'akev. What's ma'akev is what she does to him. So only the chalitza itself is ma'akev. Right? A cheresh shenechlatz, a chereshet shechaltza, a cheresh had his shoe removed from him. Or a chereshet who removed the shoe, v'choletzet the katan, or one who does chalitza with a katan, the man is a katan, chalitzata psula. All those are problematic. Ktana shechaltza, a ktana that did the process of chalitza, tachlots mishitagdil. She has to repeat it again when she grows older. Bimlo chalitza, and if she didn't do it, chalitzata psula, then it's problematic. Chalitza b'shtayim u'b'shlosha, this is the Mishnah that we just quoted in the previous Amud, which is that if she chalitza b'shtayim u'shlosha, did it in front of two or three, nimsa achad mehem karov u'pasol, chalitzata psula, then the chalitza is problematic. Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yochanan, and Lar Machshirin, they say that it's fine. Umase, Be'echad, shchalatz be'enod be'ena, be'beit asurim, uba ma'aseh lefnei Rabbi Akiva, v'yechshir. Again, the case that we quoted before in the Gemara, that when they did it privately, and then it came before Rabbi Akiva, and he was willing to be makshir in that case. Right now, the Gemara says, Amar Rava, hashtada marked, kriya lo mi'akvol. It's clear from here that you believe that the reading of the parsha is not ma'akev, because we saw in the Mishnah that everybody agrees that the kriya is not ma'akev, the chalitza. The only argument we had was about rikika, spitting, or the case of chalitza, everybody believes is problematic. But by kriya, nobody thought that was ma'akev. So now the fact that he said kriyalam akfal defikach ilaim vilemet shechaltzu chalitzatan kshera. Therefore, a person who is unable to speak, either party here, whether it's the man or the woman here, who both have parts in the process of chalitza where they need to speak, they need to read the parsha. So both, if they're ilaim or ilemet, if they did chalitza, it'll be kshera. So now it's done. Cheresh shenechlatz vecheresht shechaltzah. Mishnah says that when it comes to cheresh or chereshet that did chalitza, vacholetze min hakatan chalitza psula. My time. Why are a cheresh and chereshet? Why are they considered to be pasul when it comes to chalitza? La mishum delay v'la b'nei kriyaninu. Isn't it because they can't read the parsha? Min cheresh and chereshet. The standard cheresh and chereshet in the Mishnah, the Gemara says this. The Mishnah says it. It means deaf mute, which means that they are unable to speak as well as they are unable to hear. So the problem here by the cheresh and the chereshet is that they can't speak. And you see our Mishnah says they're psula. Lo, the Gemara says, no, that's not the reason. Mishum delav b'nei adeya ninhu. The problem by cheresh and chereshet is that they don't have the capacity to deal with it. Now this, again, we've spoken about this many times. In their day, if you were cheresh and chereshet, a person was deaf and mute, there was no way that they could learn whatsoever. There was no sign language. There was no ability to communicate with these individuals. So the assumption was that they were no different than a shoteh and a katan, that they were considered to be labdle de'an ninhu, which was that they were categorized together. As the way of chashu, which is cheresh shoteh v'katan, they're always grouped together because of this lack of de'ah. And the modern day poskim, I've mentioned this many times, say that it's just not true of a cheresh and cheresh today. So then if they're lab b'nei de'ah, then you're talking about a totally different category. The reason that cheresh and cheresh can't do the chalitza is because they lack the capacity for kavana to do it properly. So then also, why don't you say the same thing about an ilaim v'ilemet? If they can't speak, they're also not b'nei de'ah. If you're telling me that a cheresh is a problem that they're not b'nei de'ah, then say the same thing about an ilaim v'ilemet. The Gemara says, no. Amarova, ilaim v'ilemet, b'nei de'ah, ninu, upumayuhu d'kayiv luhu. They have the capacity to understand. It's just that their mouths are hurting. And that they have an equal somewhere about speaking. I mean, the key element here is clearly that they can hear. If they can hear, they can absorb knowledge. They can hear what's going on. They're able to learn. So since they're able to learn, they just can't communicate it back. That's what it means that their mouth hurts them. Their mouth hurts them means that there's some sort of physical impediment to them speaking, but it's not the lack of capacity in terms of their understanding that they can't speak. By cheresh and chereshet, it's to the point where even if they could speak, they wouldn't be able to speak because they never heard. In order to speak, speaking is a process of mimicking. So if you can't hear, you can't mimic what other people do. So therefore, they won't be able to speak, not because it's some sort of physical impediment, it's because they don't have the capacity to do that, they don't have the ability to do it. That would be the difference between ilaim and ilemet and a cheresh and chereshet. And here, obviously, that's a big nafkamina in the Mishnah as to cheresh and chereshet. Which one do you think is the problem? Do you think cheresh and chereshet is a problem because they can't speak? Or do you think the problem in the Mishnah is that they are not b'nei de'ah? Makes a big difference. Now, v'amrei debei Rabbi Yanai, l'fini she'enu ba'amar v'amra. Rabbi Yanai says, the reason that cheresh and chereshet are problematic in our Mishnah is they can't speak. So this goes against what we said before, they're not b'nei de'ah. Here it seems to be simply that they are unable to communicate, to read the parsha. If that's the case, then ilaim v'ilem, it would be knocked out. Now, what's interesting, here Tosfot asked the question, v'im tomar min alei the Rabbi Yanai. How did Rabbi Yanai know? I could read this mission, and I could tell you cheresh and chereshet are disqualified, and there's nothing in this mission that gives away, that tells you the reason the mission was posel the cheresh and chereshet is because they can't speak, or they're not b'nei de'ah. There's no information in the Mishnah that tells you why the Mishnah was posel the cheresh and chereshet. All of a sudden, to be Rabbi Yanai, I say, oh yeah, I'll tell you what the problem is, they can't speak. How does he know that? Where did he get that information from? Tosafot over here explains that, Yesh lomar, shebeitin omdim al gabam, umarim lehem lasot chalitza ketikana. It says that here, their lack of de'ah should not be a disqualifying factor over here, because we could do it hand over hand, we could instruct them, they could show them what to do and have the right kavanah. So that's why Rabbi Yanai thinks that the problem here is their inability to speak rather than de'ah, because we can overcome the problem of de'ah. We can overcome the problem by having an overseer. So an overseer can overcome that deficit in de'ah, but an overseer can't overcome the deficit in speaking, and that's why that's the deficit. That's how Tosafot says that the reason is. Other Rishonim point out that it might be because of the nature of the way that the Mishnah is put together here. Anywhere else where cheresh and chereshet are disqualified as being lav b'nei de'ah, they are grouped together with cheresh, shoteh, v'katan. Over here in our Mishnah, you don't have that. You have cheresh and chereshet segregated in the Mishnah, and having been pasul, not in that category of Chereshot de Bekatan, but just as Cheresh v'Chereshet. And that might have been what tipped Rabbi Yonai to the fact that here the psul is different. It's not because of lack of Bnei Deah, but it has to do with the fact that they can't speak. So if that's the case, then Elokit Ma Rova, then what do you do with Rova's statement? Rova's statement was a deal could have our Mishnah that says, you see that Kriya is not Ma'akev, therefore Ilayim V'Ilemet should be fine. But now that's not the case, because Cheresh and Cheresh are disqualified. So when it says, Aseifa Yitmar, that he said on the Seifa, Cheresh, Shenechlatz, Vecheresh, Shechaltza, Vecholetzet Minakatan, Chalitata Psula. Amar Rova, Asha, Damart Kriya Ma'akvo. From here you see that Kriya is Ma'akev, because Cheresh and Cheresh are disqualified because of Kriya. Fikach, Ilayim V'Ilemet, Shechaltzu, Chalitzan Psula. That's the other way. The deal would now be the opposite way, which is now I know that someone who's just mute will be disqualified, even though they're Bnei Deah. They're disqualified because they can't read. Umatniten ke Rabbi Zeira. And our Mishnah is like Rabbi Zeira. Well, didn't our Mishnah just say before that Kriya is not Ma'akev? So if they can't read it, they can't read it. What's the big deal? It's just not Ma'akev. That's because of Rabbi Zeira, a very famous statement of Rabbi Zeira that's well known. Amar Rabbi Zeira, kol ha-ro'oi levila, ein bila me'akevet bo. Anything that can be mixed, mixing is not Ma'akev. Chol she'ein ra'oi levila, anything that is not able to be mixed, bila me'akevet bo. Then, Bila is a problem. Mixing it is a problem. This is a statement from the Gemara in Menachot. It has to do with a mincha. A mincha has to be blula b'shemen. Has to be mixed with oil. The Mishnah in Menachot says that even if you don't mix it, it's still kasher, b'diavad. In that chatchila, you're supposed to mix it. But if you don't mix it, it's still good to go korban. Now, what happens if a person says, I want to bring a huge mincha of 61 isaron? There, the Gemara says he has to bring two menachot. Because the Chachamim, Kimle the Rabbanon. The Rabbanon said that the mixers in those days could only handle 60 Isaron. If you were above 60 Isaron, there's just no way you can mix the oil and the flour together. You couldn't do Belila. My ass over there. Okay. So don't do Belila. Let him bring 61, not do Belila. You just told me that Belila is not Me'akev. So this is where Rabbi Zeira's statement comes up. He says, if you have the potential to do Belila, if you have the potential to mix it, then if you don't mix it, you're okay. Whereas, if you can't possibly mix it, then Bila is Ma'akev. Then the fact that you didn't mix it is Ma'akev the process. The potential to mix it is enough to make it kasher b'diavad. But it has to be in potential. If you don't have that potential, then it is Ma'akev. So that's the case by Menachot. Once you're over 60 Isaron, there's no way you can do it, and therefore it's going to be Ma'akev the Bila. At 60 Isaron, you could have mixed it. You didn't mix it, fine, then it's not Ma'akev. Same thing over here. With regards to Kriya. Kriya is not Ma'akev when you have the ability to read. When you have the ability to say it, then it's not Ma'akev. And that's what the Mishnah means, that Kriya is not Ma'akev. But if you are unable to speak and you're unable to do Kriya, Kriya will be Ma'akevet. Then Kriya will be a problem. And that's how we explain the Mishnah. So that's why in the beginning of the Mishnah it says Kriya is not Ma'akev and it's not Pasol because there they had the potential to read and they didn't. The latter half of the Mishnah says Cheresh v'Chereshet are Nifsalin is because they can't physically read. Since they can't read, they're disqualified, even though it's not, Kriya is not Ma'akev, based on this position of Rabbi Zeira. That's the principle of Rabbi Zeira. Now Tosafot says, why does the Gemara even have a question in Menachot? Rabbi Zeira's issue, which is he says, I said I want to bring a Korban that is 61 Isaron. The Gemara says you have to split it into a 60 and 1. So what's the Hava Mino that he should be able to bring a 61 Isaron Mincha? Even if you say, okay, you can't mix it, it's not Ma'akev. Why would you think he can make it? The Chatkili is supposed to mix it. Why would we let him bring a mincha that he can't mix if the chatkila is supposed to mix it? Okay, b'diavad, it's fine. Who lets him bring a mincha b'diavad? Tell him bring 60 and 1, too bad. Tosafot says that there's a mitigating factor over there because when he donated or promised to bring the mincha, he says, I want to bring a 61 Isaron mincha. He says, I want to bring a really big mincha. I want to bring this one huge mincha. Now we're going to change his words and say he can bring like one of 60 and one of one. We're not going to let him bring what he said. So the Gemara's Havamina was that in order to accomplish what he said, we'll let him do it b'diavad. But then the Gemara says, no, in the end, that's not the case because if you can't do it, we won't let you bring it. And therefore, it's ma'akev, the whole process over there. And then Tosafot deals with the Gemara Menachot. It's more unique to the Gemara Menachot. But the word blula b'shemen appears so many times in the Torah with regards to a mincha. And we have a principle in Kodashim. Anything that's repeated twice is automatically ma'akev. Then why if it says blula b'shemen so many times, it's not ma'akev? Where did the Gemara come up with the fact that it's not ma'akev? So Tosafot gives some interesting answers, including one which is, we use them for other drashot. We don't have any drashot. We don't know what the drashot are, but they're all used for some drasha. They're not extraneous, so therefore you can't say that they're Ma'akev. Or, he says that it is a svara. that blula amarchan alamakva mistama achiyahani adaktiva beinan roi lebila. Says just it's a svara because it says blula b'shem and it doesn't say it in the active form. When it wants to tell you something that's me'akev, it tells you in the active form ubalal over like relivol that you have to mix it. The fact that it says blula b'shem that it is mixed, which is the passive verb, that shows you that it's not me'akev. Just a logical argument that it's not me'akev. Now the Gemara continues. Shalcholei l'avua d'shmuel. They sent this question to Avua d'shmuel. Avua d'shmuel. Shmuel is an Amora in Bavel, first second generation Amora in Bavel, contemporary of Rav. His father, Avua d'shmuel, is one of those in the in-between generation between the Tanaim and the Amorim. He's one of the bridge generations there. So Avua d'shmuel is quoted many times in the Gemara. He doesn't have exactly the standing of a Tana, but he's still a little bit above an Amora because he's in that transition generation. Yevama shirakaka tachlots. A yevama that spits does chalitza. Michlau deifsala miachin. Right, so it sounds like that if she spits, she should do chalitza, which means that when she spat, that means that she was automatically disqualified of the brothers, and now there's only one option, which is chalitza. So here you have a statement, which is once she's done the spitting already, she's got to finish off the chalitza. Which means that she's already done something that causes a problem here. The spinning itself has implications. That's what it seems from the position of Avua d'shmuel. So as Mani, who's the author of that position? Ilam Rabbi Kiva. If you think it's Rabbi Kiva, Ashka, Makom Mitzvah, Dikal Meimar Mide Dahava, Aimurim, Tichilet Nehulo Makve, Vichit Nehu Makve. So here, when it's a Makom Mitzvah, so now you could say it's similar to Aimurim. Aimurim are the fats of a Korban. The fats of a Korban, if the fats are there, you cannot eat the basar korban unless the fats get on the mizbech. If the fats are not there at all, whatever, they became tamei, they were lost, then you can eat the korban even without the emurim. So again, the emurim are only an issue when they are present. If they're not present, they're not an issue. I mean, it's a mitzvah to put the emurim on the mizbech and to eat the meat after that. Amar Rabbi Kiva lo makva. Over there, Rabbi Kiva argues and says that they're not makev at all. Me'achim ifsula. Over here, are going to say that she's pasul when they ekva. We know that Rabbi Kiva in the Mishnah already says that the spitting is not ma'akev. So there, if the spitting's not ma'akev over here, then certainly in a case where she just spat and did nothing else, why should that be considered a part of the procedure? Why should that force that there's something happening over here? If in the context of the mitzvah, spitting is not essential, then outside the context of the mitzvah, why should spitting have any meaning? Over there by Emurim. Again, when the Emurim are missing, we say, don't worry about the Emurim. The Emurim are there, and it's a mitzvah to bring on the Mizbech. Where, when the Emurim are present, we say they are Me'akev. Nevertheless, Rabbi Akiva says here, by the case of Chalitza, even though the Rikika is still available for us to do, we don't make her go back and do it. We say that it's not Me'akev, even though it's still plausible or possible to do the Rikika, then certainly Rabbi Akiva doesn't believe that Rikika, outside the context of Chalitza, will have any meaning whatsoever. So Rabbi Akiva was unwilling to extrapolate the din that we know that is true by the Emurim over to here by Rikika, which would imply that by Rikika you'd have to spit afterwards because there is the ability to spit. Nevertheless, Rabbi Akiva says it's not ma'akev, you don't have to do anything. So again, here, what are you going to say? When she spits outside the context of the mitzvah, why is there any havamina to say that it has any meaning? So it can't be Rabbi Akiva. Ela ala Rabbi Elazar or Rabbi Eliezer or Mishnah. Vashnei devarim amatirim ninu. Wait a minute, Rabbi Lezer, who says that spitting is ma'akev, so you're going to say he's the author of this position? Wait, don't we have here two things that are matir? Because according to Rabbi Lezer, there are two parts of the procedure that are ma'akev. One is spitting, the other one is the chalitza. And according to this principle, that when you have two items that are the generators of the next stage, they're the things that matir, you can't do one without the other. So if you're spitting independent of chalitza, is meaningless. Chalitza without spitting is also meaningless, man. Each one independently is meaningless. Elik Rabbi. This position that Avua d'shmuel stating must be like Rabbi, again, which would make a lot of sense because Avua d'shmuel is very much a contemporary of Rabbi. And therefore, the fact that he's quoting this psak based on Rabbi's position would make a lot of sense. The Tanya. Kifsei atzeret, ein mekadshim alechem. That the kivsei atzeret are not mekadesh le'ochem, elo b'shchita, when they're shechted. What we're speaking about here is the korban that is brought on Shavuot. The korban that's brought on Shavuot involves kivsei atzeret, which are the only shlamim of the tzibur, the shalmei tzibur that are brought on Shavuot. Along with them are brought the two loaves of bread, the shtei alechem. And the shtei alechem requires tufa, a wave offering with the animal. You have a live wave offering, which is that the animals themselves and the breads are lifted and there's a wave offering done with them. And then afterwards, you shech the korban. When you shech the kivsei atzeret, that's what's mikadesh the lechem. That's what triggers the kedusha and the lechem. Now, beforehand, the lechem had kedusha tamim. They were dedicated to the mikdash. They were possession of the mikdash or kodesh. But they were put into klisha, right? They don't become kedushat aguf until the shechita of the animals. And has implications in terms of lina. If it's left overnight, it becomes pasul. Problems of pigul. All sorts of other issues that come up once they are already kedushat aguf. You can't redeem them. Versus if they're only kedushat tamim, then none of these issues apply. So when is that threshold from when you move from kedushat tamim to kedushat aguf from the bread? That's with the shechita of the kivsei atzeret. Ketzad, shechtan lishman. If you did the shechita lishman, meaning for the right purpose, and you did the zrika adam properly, kidesh alechem, then the lechem becomes kadosh. That it works. That you did it right. Shachat shelo lishman. If you did the shechita lo l'shem kivsei atzeret, v'zarak lishman, but you did the zrika lishma, lo kidesh alechem, then the lechem doesn't become kadosh because you failed to do the kivsei atzeret properly. If you fail to do them, they don't affect the lechem. Shachtan lishman. If you did the shechita lishman, v'zarak daman shelo lishman. Did the zrika shelo lishman, kadosh, veino kadosh. Then it is partly kadosh, but not fully kadosh. Divrei Rabbi. That's Rabbi's opinion. Rabbi Shimon omer lo'olam eino kadosh, ashi shchot lishman, vizrok daman lishman. Then until you do both of these processes, there is no kiddush alechem. So you see here from Rabbi Shimon's position, when you have two matirin, the two things that drive the lechem to become kadosh is if the kivsei atzeret are done properly. How are they done properly? Shchita and zrika. The shechita and zrika are the triggers or the matirim for the lechem. So since they are the two matirim for the lechem, one without the other will not suffice. You need both of them, not just one of them. That's according to Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Shimon. But Rabbi says, kadosh, veino kadosh. So Rabbi says, even when you have two matirim, there is a possibility that it works partially and not fully. So now, what does that mean that it's kadosh and not kadosh? So it's kadosh in the sense that all the psulim can apply now. So if it's taken out of the azara, it becomes pasul. If it's left overnight, lina, it becomes pasul. All the psulim apply. Ain't no kadosh? It's not kadosh enough that you can eat it, that the kohanim will be able to eat it afterwards. So kadosh enough that it gains all the psulim that come with kedushat aguf. Ain't no kadosh is that it doesn't matir it, it doesn't allow it now to be eaten by the kohanim, because the matir of the dam was not put there. So what you see from Rabbi is that even though there are two matirim here, shechita and shrikat adam, so if Rabbi Lazar and Rabbi Shimon is consistent with what we saw with Rabbi Lazar, which is shnei devarim ha-matirim. When you have two matirim, then those two matirim are ma'akev each other, and you can't do one without the other. So that's what he says, shechita and zrika. The shechita is mekadesh the lechem, the zrika is matir the lechem for the kohanim. One without the other is a zero. That's what Rabbi Lazar and Rabbi Shimon says. Rabbi says, no, that's not the case. Shechita is mekadesh the lechem, zrika is matir the lechem to the kohanim. So if you do just shechita, then you got to the point where the lechem is kadosh, kedushat aguf. You didn't do zrika lishma, so you didn't get it matir the kohanim. Obviously, in reverse, it won't work. Because if you're never mekadesh the lechem, kedushat aguf, then the zrika adam is not going to help you because they weren't kadosh, kedushat aguf. But you see from Rabbi that when you have two matirim, one can function without the other. So too over here, we can say the same thing, that even though the spitting and the chalitzar are both matirim, both ma'akim each other, nevertheless, doing one without the other has impact. So the spitting here has impact. And what's the two stages in chalitza? Let's say by the lechem, the shtei lechem, the two stages are one, it gets kedushat aguf. The second stage is that it's mutar for the kohanim to eat it. Over here, the two stages are that she's disqualified from performing yibum with the brothers. The second stage is mutar to marry other people. So it's over here. So spitting will generate one of those two, which is she's psula le'achim. So that's what Avad Shmuel said. If she spits, she may as well do it. She's got to do chalitza because that's the only choice now. Yibum is no longer an option. She needs the chalitza now to be matar here to everyone else. So Gemara says, Umi amar Rabbi Akiva rekika lo paslo. Does Rabbi Akiva really believe that if she did rekika, it will not be posel her from the achim? That's what we established until this point. Katanyo, we have a brayta that seems to indicate otherwise. Chalitza velo rakika velo kara. She did chalitza, but she did not spit and she did not read the parsha. Chalitza takshira. It's good. Rakika. She did the spitting, velo chalitza velo kara. She did just the spitting, chalitza tapsula. Kara, velo rakika, velo chalitza. She did the reading and did do the rikika, velo chalitza. Ain't kan beit michush. Then you're not talking about anything. Mani, who's the author of this braita? Ilema Rabbi Eliezer. If it's Rabbi Eliezer, chalitza, velo rakika, velo kara, chalitza takshira. So we said, Rabbi Eliezer, kacha yase, davar shu mase ma'akev. In the case where she just does chalitza, not spitting and not reading, she's going to say kshira. We just saw that the position of Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Elazar in our Mishnah is that rikikaz me'akev. So it's clearly she's not kshera. In that case, that's not a chalitza kshera. Who's the opinion that says that chalitza by itself is enough? That's Rabbi Akiva. Obshita, it's Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva is the author of this braita. What did this braita just say? Viktani, rakakava lo chalitza, velo kara. If you did the spinning, but no chalitza, no kriya, chalitza ta psula. So you see, according to Rabbi Akiva, it seemingly is that the chalitza is psula when you're talking about a case where she left out the rikika. So how can you say that Rabbi Akiva believes that rikika is not me'akev? Laman. Where it says, to who is she pasul? Ilei mala alma. If she is psula le alma, pshita. Mi havia chalitza di shtari le alma. There's no chalitza here that she can be mutar, right? Olav lachin. It must be psula means lachin. Shmamina. So from here you see that Rabbi Akiva says, rikika also generates that same problem. Rikika is posel her to the achim. Even though it's not me'akev the process, it still is posel her to the achim. Right, says Rabbi Akiva, maishna rikika or maishna kriya. So then, according to Rabbi Akiva, we have two processes here that are not ma'akev. Respitting is not ma'akev, and reading is not ma'akev, but different issues. When you spit, even though it's not ma'akev, if she does it, it has impact, and now she's pasul liachim. Another by kriya, if she does kriya with anything else, no impact whatsoever. But Rabbi Akiva thinks they're both not ma'akev. Why is there a difference between rikika and kriya? So Gemara says, that's because kriya, the ita ben mitkila ben mitsof, reading that's done both before and afterwards, lo miflecha le. That won't get mixed up with chalitza. Because she reads, or there's a process of her reading both before she does the chalitza, as well as after she does the chalitza. So there you're not getting confused and say that kriya, it'll be the same thing like also by chalitza. You spit before you do the chalitza, it's meaningless. Only if you do it afterwards, then miflecha le. People will get confused. Va'ate mishrei chalutza le'achin. And then people might also be matir a chalutza le'achin. Because if she just spits, and then you say, okay, she spat, and now she can go back to the brothers. She can perform yibum with the brothers. What are people going to think? That when you only do one of the processes, then nothing happened, and you can do yibum afterwards. But that's not true by chalitza. If she had done one process, the only part she did was do chalitza, she would be out. She could not be with the brothers. So now what you're afraid of is that if you tell them by spitting that she's allowed to then perform yibum, people will say the same thing by chalitza. And it's just not true. By chalitza, it's me'akev, and it will ruin it for, and therefore, it's problematic. By rikika, it won't do that. So tell Rabbi Kiva goes there. By rikika, meaning midrabanan. He says that rikika is problematic in order to prevent a problem getting mixed up with chalitza. By kriya, kriya is done both before and after the process. So nobody's going to think that kriya is similar to chalitza. Because you read before the chalitza and you read afterwards. It's clear that the kriya is something different. Then it's a separate type of entity or a different type of part of the process. And so you're not going to mix them up. And since you're not going to mix them up, kriya is not me'akev ever. Even if she does kriya, we'll let her marry the brothers afterwards because kriya has no impact whatsoever. All right, so we're stopping here 15 lines down on Kuf Hei Amud Aleph.